ready. It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 554 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week is a special doubleheader episode with two favorites returning. It all kicks off with Tom Pinchuk from Remember Andy Zenon. He has a new series debuting called Clash of the Classics. The very first issue deals with Don Quixote fighting the War of the Worlds. It's described this way. Humanity has an unlikely defender in Don Quixote in this action-packed tale of aliens versus knights. Then everything wraps up with the return of Nandor Schaefer, the creator of Seasons, who has a new series out called Manchild. Issues 1 and 2 are now available at Kickstarter. The book is described this way. Monarch Crier and Rufus return as fantasy and reality collide in this tribute to the work and life of Stan Lee and comic book fandom. After you listen to our fun conversation, be sure to back this excellent project on Kickstarter that will conclude Saturday, October 1st at 8:08 p.m. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what both of them have to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome back to the podcast Tom Pinchuk, creator of Remember Andy Zenon and many other good things, has a new book out called Quixote War. Clash of the Classics, Don Quixote Fights the War of the Worlds. How's it going?
Great. Good to be back.
It's good to talk with you. Now, when did this actually hit the stands, or when was it first become available?
Oh, it's never, there's no stands to hit. It's a digital exclusive. So it's on a new platform called Kipsil that they really liked Andy Zenon. And so they invited me to make some comics for them and, you know, commission the project. So it's, at the moment, it's only available digitally. So there's no stands involved. We've been in a bit of a soft launch since Comic-Con. Where we were just kind of doing a little bit of it was kind of fun. It felt like being a secret agent in some ways, because I was handing out these cards with the QR codes on them, just saying that they wanted early access. But now it's available to everybody all over the world.
Okay, great. Now before we leave the subject, I really enjoyed Remember Andy Zenon really well. I had a chance. I got that through Zoop, which you had done, and when I read it, I was really intrigued because I've always wondered what would happen to Ben Tannen's characters like that when they get older. And this book really answered that question for me really well, and I thought that was really terrific.
Thank you. Well, you're the audience I wrote it for. I've been working on Kid Adventure series for a few years, and we can never let them grow up. And I was thinking, what's the best use of the medium is to explore something I can't do elsewhere. So that was the whole, you know, genesis of that idea. And I found as I delved deeper into it, just the more interesting the story got to me. So it's really great to hear that from you, because that's exactly what I was hoping for.
Any more of Andy Zenon, or is that going to be it?
I have loose ideas for follow-ups. I was kind of thinking of it as an anthology series as well, perhaps about there might be other one-shots about other characters in his world. But I didn't go into it with an expectation that this was going to be a extended prologue. I mean, I kept telling everybody involved to take the notion of one shot to heart, because I feel like a lot of times when comics, they kind of promise that it's a self-contained issue, or that it's not, it's not going to be an extended, it's not going to end on a cliffhanger, and then it does. So there's definitely room to do more, but there's not immediate plans for it yet. Nikos and I actually, we reunited for this project, which was fantastic. And we have, more stuff in the works actually. So that will be a follow-up, but it won't necessarily involve Andy right away. I mean, we've been hearing some people asking, you know, people have been asking if there's going to be more. So I think at a certain point we may want to respond to demand. But I really wanted to take it to heart just and mean it that we were not leaving anything off the table when we made that book.
Like Don Quixote fights Andy Zenon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose anything's possible. Yeah, that would be an interesting one.
Well, I'd like to see more of Andy Zenon, because I thought that was a very smart book, and I loved the characters, and I thought it ended particularly well. So I'd like to see more of that.
Well, I'll keep that in mind. Yeah, you're not the only one. It's an interesting process, just because I told that to one of the artists who was involved, and he was insisting that we had to do another one. It was one of the guest artists, and he likened it to the first season of Breaking Bad, actually. You know, I suppose you could think of a more disparate comparison, but I'm not the biggest devotee of that show, but he's a huge fan, and he was telling me that I guess when the show was in production for the first season, they knew the writer's strike was going to be coming, and so they were thoroughly convinced they weren't going to get a second season. So I think that they were initially planning for a slower burn of Walter White's descent into criminality, and I think they decided to really just accelerate it to make that season the best it could be, and it wound up weirdly making them victims of their own success, because then they got renewed for a second season, and they had to go back to the drawing board. So I think maybe that is something I've thought a bit about, is just the fact that maybe, even though I didn't set it out to make it a continuing serial, perhaps because we made it as good as we could and didn't bank on there being more. Ironically, that means it could be easy to make more. So that's, believe me, it's on our minds.
See, I think that's what happened to Lost on ABC. They didn't expect to get picked up, and all of a sudden they got picked up and they said, holy smoke, what are we going to do?
It's honestly, if you look at the history of a lot of epic serials, they almost always do a retconning in real life, maybe, but they act like there was a plan all along. I think Star Wars being a big example, obviously, if you've listened to enough interviews with George Lucas, I think maybe he had loose ideas and he liked the idea of this feeling like you dropped in the middle of a serial, but he certainly didn't have it all mapped out. The one anecdote that I always love is the fact that Tolkien wrote The Hobbit, and then he had some more ideas that kept gnawing at his mind after that, and then he wrote this long manuscript for Lord of the Rings expecting it to be just one book, and his publisher said, this is absurd. we can't make a book this long. We're going to split it up into three. And I just always find that kind of amusing, just because the fact that that's always pointed to as the most iconic trilogy, I suppose, in adventure fiction. And even that was really more of a sales gimmick. It was not intended to be that way.
Right, right. So that's kind of interesting how those things work out. You never know when you're creating something how it's going to actually turn out. So.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of ways that there's kind of the illusion that gets created that there was a plan the whole time. I know that, I think definitely polarizing opinions about the special editions of Star Wars, but I also think of Stephen King's Dark Tower novels, where he actually went back and started rewriting some of the early ones to be more compatible with the later ones. And so, I think any comics fan is well aware of retcons and Marvel or DC, where there's certain plans that were certainly not there from the beginning.
Right.
And then whenever there's an adaptation, they sort of have this question of do we go with what the later revelation was, or do we just go with the initial version of it?
Right. That's true. Because so many times you're never exactly sure. So that's pretty interesting. So talk about this Clash of the Classics. How did this come to be? I mean, where did the idea originally come from?
Well, I was brought in into Kipcell initially as in a consultant capacity, and they were interested in getting in the comic space, and I guess they liked my advice so much that they said, hey, why don't we make comics with you? And then early on, I don't remember if I suggested it or if it was their idea, but we kind of figured it would be better to start with classic characters. And I've had strong opinions about that. I feel like there's often cases where I've seen it done badly for sure, and more often than I would like. I told them from the get-go I really didn't want to make this Dracula versus Frankenstein and Oz, because I think there's been too much of that for sure. I think League of Extraordinary Gentlemen's a huge influence on me, and I think what I appreciated about those comics were the fact that you could tell that the creators had read the original novels and had really brought them forward, warts and all, as opposed to relying on whatever the popular conception was. I feel like a lot of time when you see books that are pastiche of Dracula, it's not really so much based on Bram Stoker's book, for instance, but it's based on not even the Bela Lugosi movie, but just clips of it that the creators have seen without really delving into it. And so that's what I found really fascinating. I was really committed to this, that I wanted to make, delve into the books and delve into H.G. Wells and Cervantes and make sure that these felt accurate in the sense that it's a very precise tone that we were going for. I think it's a blend of action and drama and comedy for sure, because I think that would not having any of that or not having a precise balance of that would do disservice to the premise and to the characters. But part of the humor for me was almost playing it as straight as we could, despite how absurd it would get. So that was it was just a fascinating journey, because something that I was struck by, and I brought this up a few times actually to anybody who's willing to listen, is that it didn't really occur to me until I read Don Quixote that it was its era's version of Kick-Ass.
Wow. I never thought of that before.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, right? I mean, the premise of Kick-Ass is that this kid reads too many superhero comics and he starts to think that he is a superhero. And at least in the comics version, I think they gave it a much happier ending and it was much brighter in the movie version. But in the comics version, it's all about how he doesn't know what he's doing and he keeps getting his ass kicked, right?
Right.
And then when I was reading Don Quixote, it just struck me that, well, there's this wealthy noble and they think that he's going a little losing touch on reality, and whether that's accelerated by his readings of Tales of Chivalry or if it's a product of that, it's a little unclear. But either way, he starts to see himself as being like a knight in King Arthur's court. And it's something that maybe you lose a little sight of when you're removed from the years that the book was written in. But King Arthur and all that was considered ancient history even back then. So it was considered absurd that you'd have a knight trying to fight giants or have a squire and win the favor of a lady love at that time in Spain. And so, again, the continual joke in that book is that he doesn't understand the situation that's in front of him, and he gets his ass kicked.
Right.
So I was struck by that, and I think that we were – the operative word we were using a lot of throughout the process was disruptive. So to my mind, I think – If it will make sense, we wanted to make one that we had done our homework, but it was irreverent at the same time. So,
right.
To me, what was really amusing about the prospect of playing with this character in particular was just ruining the entire point Cervantes was trying to make with Don Quixote. I keep saying I hope he and H.G. Wells are both rolling over in their graves about this comic. But to me, what I thought would be hilarious would be, well, what if you change the circumstances, if in his own time or his own story, Don Quixote is the right man for the wrong time? And what if you threw in the Martian invasion into this and it turned out he had been training for this opportunity and he winds up being the only man in Spain who has trained as a giant killer? And, oh, there happened to be these tripods lumbering around who are giants, and so who better equipped to fight against them and to win than Don Quixote?
It's so interesting to me because I love team ups and crossovers and things like that, and so when I started to read this, I was kind of interested to see how you're going to handle this, because these are two very different stories in that sense, that the War of the Worlds, of course, I always think is set in like the 1940s, 1950s and stuff. And Don Quixote is back in 1800s at least, or earlier than that. Well, I was intrigued how differently that you made the War of the Worlds. You had to adapt it to Don Quixote's time, and so the machines and stuff are not quite like what we're used to seeing in War of the Worlds. So I thought you did a great job of adapting it to fit that character in this time.
Yeah, I mean, I think even the stories go back even further than you might be aware. I think H.G. Wells was writing in like the late 19th century, I want to say. With those, it's just, I think it's been such a timeless story with War of the Worlds that it seems to fit in whatever era that it's put into. But when we were doing an early stage of this, it was Kipsell who had the idea, perhaps, that we should make the tripods more steampunk-esque or to reflect the era, because I guess, you know, it was all about following our own sense of logic, however crazy it was. And in this case, it was, the thought was, well, if technology on Earth is several hundred years less advanced than what we would have seen in the time of the Wells novel, then it stands to reason that the Martians' technology would also be less advanced.
Right, right. And it's so interesting to me to see how this works. And I'm always fascinated by Don Quixote not being surprised or intimidated by things that he comes across. And you make a point of that in the book, in the comic, about the fact that he is not put aside by that. In fact, because they're giants, he actually says, hey, these are giants. That's what we're supposed to take on. Which I really liked. I thought that was great to see him, because, you know, so many of us would be running the other direction, but he's like a police officer in many ways. He runs towards the danger.
Well, yeah, I mean, we wanted to have as much fun with the sense that he's still deranged, and he's perhaps not, he's not seeing what everybody else is seeing, and he's maybe not grasping the situation that he's in. It's just, the joke is that he's still kicks ass. So mm-hmm. a lot of the fun for me was the fact that you have all these reasonable and sane people around him who understand that he's still this madman, but they also understand he's really good at fighting Martians, so they have to put up with him.
Right.
So the analogy I wound up that I think made a lot of sense to me was that he's like this big brat of a rock star. And he's surrounded by his entourage, or perhaps the people running the concert venue, or what have you. And Sancho Panza winds up becoming the manager who has to serve as the middleman between them of explaining his irrational moods or his whatever bizarre behavior he's going to that completely baffles everybody around him.
I was intrigued too how you handled the Martians. I thought that was an interesting thing, because I was concerned they were going to be more, too pointed antennae and stuff like that. But you didn't do that at all. You did something very different, which I really liked. And I thought that was an interesting way to go about that. Why did you go that route with the Martians that you did?
They're actually that's how they're described in the book. We really tried to make that accurate, in the sense that they're these slug creatures, these slug-like creatures that have just a mess of tentacles, and they have this really nasty beak and these beady eyes. I think if it winds up feeling novel, I suppose in 2022, it's probably because, again, I think unfortunately sometimes the popular conception of some of these stories winds up eclipsing the I guess by nature they do, but. They eclipse what's in the novel. So that was something that we were really, just speaking to the sense of really trying to capture that authenticity, it also just made it more fun to me to make it as accurate as we could to the novel. But then when we were taking creative license, we knew exactly what we were doing and why.
Well, I also love the green goop all over the place. There's green stuff on the cover, and there's green stuff inside. As Don Quixote takes on these people, let's just say, of course, when you're fighting with a sword, you're likely to use that sword as the thing that you do. And of course, when he does that and cuts into things, we see green stuff everywhere. And I got a huge kick out of that, because, you know, Martians were always called the little green men and stuff like that. So to see the green stuff everywhere, I thought was kind of fun. That's one thing too I also noticed about the story. You had fun with it, as well as the adventure. Like, there's one time when Quixote is fighting these things, and the villagers are standing there looking at him, and they're all kind of like, whoa. And then all of a sudden they all start to talk, but they all say something different, which I thought was kind of fun. So the fun aspects as well as the adventure really made this stand out to me.
Yeah, I think that doing a really dour, grim take on Don Quixote would be a massive misunderstanding of the character and the book. It goes back to what I haven't liked about comics in particular that have played with these characters, these classic characters before, is just the fact that they just seem to misunderstand it sometimes. You know, there's a lot of them that have more of a humorous angle or satire to them that I think get missed or lost in translation, if it were. So that was something that we were really, I was committed. I think Nikos was on board with me about that. I have a lot of thoughts about the kind of proper balance of action comedy. Weirdly enough, I think often about like cartoons that I watched as a kid that I always preferred, say, Spy versus Spy over Tom and Jerry, because at least in Spy versus Spy, you didn't know what the outcome was going to be every time. Whereas Tom and Jerry was just that, I know that the mouse is going to win. And another one that I particularly didn't like was George of the Jungle, just because I think it winds up becoming really one note. And I was just watching reruns, by the way, in the early days of Cartoon Network when it was just a rerun channel. But I think that there's, to my mind, there's a really delicate balance. Even you can go too far with action and drama and not have any sort of comic relief. I always think of that as being like playing one note or one riff over and over again without letting the other members of the band do their jobs. But on the opposite end of it, I think that a comedy where you know what the outcome's going to be every time and you know that the character's just going to lose over and over again, I don't find that as interesting either. So we really did try to find a delicate balance to the tone. And I think Nikos's art actually goes a long way to help that as well, just because, you know, I think at first glance you might think of his work as cartoony, but then when you look closer at it, he really pays a lot of attention to texture and to a sense of weight to his characters and the subjects that I find really appealing. There are artists who I think swing too far in one direction or the other, but I think he really mm-hmm. hits that sweet spot. Mm-hmm. It's interesting too when you bring up the goo, just because that was probably the note that I wound up giving him the most during the coloring stage, was just more goo, more goo. I really wanted to put it to the point of excess because I felt like that was something that would make it more undignified but also more intense at the same time.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because, you know, we do see the color green in a lot of the different places inside the story. There's one time when we're in his office of sorts, and he's got jars, and inside the jars are green goo, among other things. And I got a huge kick out of that because I didn't expect that. That was something that surprised me, was to see that in – is that his office? What is that where we see him?
Without saying too much, yeah, he meets someone who might be able to help him, and then that reflects some of the alchemist practices of the day. We did a bit of research about that. It's interesting because, I think when you start, without getting too far down the rabbit hole, I think sometimes that people tend to think that science really only began maybe 100 or 200 years ago, and you actually look further back and you'll find really some predecessors to it where they may not necessarily have the methodology that we use now, but there are grasping at the same things. So in that case, he finds someone who has been studying the Martians and provides some clues and some insights, which of course he drastically misinterprets and missees. I really wanted to make a comic here that you would have no idea where it was going to be going from scene to scene. I think there's an initial sense of what the story might be when you look at the cover, say, but then I wanted each scene to really just flip you around and you really have no idea where it's going and you have no idea what it's escalating to. And I wanted to have that sort of, not just in a sense of engaging storytelling, you know, if I could say so myself, but also just the fact that I think it will reflect a mounting sense of mania in the character as well, which I hope will come across for anybody reading it.
Well, as you get along, you take a very surprising turn to me that I did not expect. And we don't have to say what it is, but let's just say Don Quixote, you keep saying he makes turns and stuff like that. There's a big surprise as we get towards the end of the story as to what Quixote decides he's got to do to resolve the situation. Very surprised by that. I thought that was a great way to do that. And it's just a big old shock to me, which I really liked.
That's exactly what I was hoping to hear. I'm hoping with all of these, all these clashes of the classics, that I really want it to be something that you're not going to be able to predict what happens next, even if you have the premise or you have ideas about how one book may interact with the other one. What I also hope is that even as shocking or surprising as it is when you read it, it follows its own internal logic. In this case, even with Quixote, he's a madman, but he has his own consistency to how he approaches things.
So we're not likely to see this combination again in the future?
Anything's possible. The plan right now is it's an anthology series, like I mentioned. I think it's been easier to explain to people as being like What If, but with classic adventure characters. So the plan is we'll take the format, I should say, is that we take a character from one classic novel and drop them in the plot of another, and then just see what sort of chaos unfolds and just with an unblinking eye. So, you know, we have a few teased at the end. I'm trying to get too far ahead of myself, so you'll have to read the book to find out what those are. But the scripts have already been written, but we're taking our time. I think one of the benefits of working in digital as opposed to printing is that we can take our time. And this is something where we really want to make sure that we polish each one shot in this anthology and make it as good as it can be before we release it, rather than having to stick to some arbitrary schedule saying this has to come out every month. So there will be more. We're just in the process of working on it right now, so I can't quite say yet.
Do you have an idea how often you want them to come out, or is it just when you get them done and they're ready, then you release them?
When they're done and good, I think will be, that's the operative term. And it's interesting because I think like during the pandemic, in all the ways that it sort of gave people time for more things they wouldn't have had time for before, you know, I read a lot of comics that that had really stuck with me over the years. And something that I noticed, I always kind of refer to it sometimes as like the X-ray glasses, where it's like once you've had a little more experience with making something, it's like you can put the X-ray glasses on and see what the blueprints were behind it and the schematics. And I definitely started getting more of an eye for a comic that was produced as a periodical, say like on a monthly or weekly schedule, versus one that was prestige format and came out when it was done. So I think, for instance, like Dark Knight Returns or, say, Watchmen or, you know, there's plenty of other books that were produced, they were called prestige format. They were often late. They came out when they were done. But I think what's key is that whenever they were collected, I think those wind up being the ones that stand the test of time a bit better, just because there's was time to refine them. I think that's it's something as well that if you have a movie that you really enjoy and you think it works out being more timeless, it's often because they had time for revisions. They had time for fine tuning rather than having to hit an arbitrary date. So I would say probably it wouldn't be like another year, but I would hope it'd be like within a few months. But I don't want to commit to anything yet because, you know, it's like it's sort of like how airlines these days will massively overestimate how long a flight's going to take, so you're never late.
Right.
So that's kind of my attitude these days. It's just I don't want to, you know, under-promise and over-deliver.
Are you thinking about putting these in print eventually, or are you going to keep them digital?
Kipsell, for the moment, is making those decisions, and they're pretty committed to it being digital. So that's how it is for the moment. We have actually had some interest from some outside parties about maybe doing it in print, but I think they're still committed to wanting to keep it digital because that's what it was created for. I would certainly, you know, I'm a fan of both. I like digital comics. I like print comics. I like floppies. I like hardcovers. It's all good by me, but I think that's the best format for it right now.
Because it might be fun to have a bunch of these, talking about anthologies, you could have a bunch of these stories in one book. Would kind of be fun for people, I think.
Yeah, I think there will eventually be a collected edition. But whether that's digital or if it's going to be in print remains to be seen. I think we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
Okay. Now you do list a couple of possibilities at the end of the book, and you probably don't want to talk about those quite yet. But there's stuff. You mentioned a few things that could happen. Some of them I'm not familiar with, which is interesting to me. So I'd be curious to see when you get to some of these in the future.
Well, without maybe getting into too many of the mashups, I can talk about some of the books that I was reading as research. And something that really stuck out to me, going back to what I was saying before, which is how often that you might have someone, I almost unwittingly saying that they were going to do some darker take in quotes on one of these classic books, or were doing a deconstructionist take or finding meaning that wasn't intentionally there. And more often than not, when I read the books, it was already there. Like it was, it's not subtext, it's text. So for instance, I would say Peter Pan is actually pretty Freudian. It's a lot more overt than you would have thought. It's also something that I think gets misinterpreted in the sense that, you know, on the one hand, it is about the innocence in a respect of like what it would be like to be a boy forever. But it's also, the message is pretty clear that, for one, Peter would be missing out on a lot of what being an adolescent and an adult has to offer a boy. It's not really. That's presented pretty clearly as a tragedy in itself. But then the other aspect of it as well, and this is the part that I always like find funny, when you know, every so often you see some editorial about like, and it's always about the Disney version, about how, like, did you notice that Peter is actually kind of a jerk? And it's like, yes. when you read the book, it's like, it's all about how he's a little shit. Like he's impulsive and he doesn't really have a care for people's feelings, because that's how most children are. You know, that's what you develop as you mature. Mm-hmm. The other one that I found pretty interesting was the fact that, you know, I heard about later kind of pastiches, I should say, or reinterpretations of Sherlock Holmes, like the 7% solution that had talked about his cocaine habit, as if it were something that people of the era reading the books weren't aware of the dangers of, or they just thought it might have been a good thing or what have you. And then I read one of the stories, and it just says straight up at the beginning, Watson refers to Holmes as having a cocaine problem. It was a character flaw. So these were written actually for an adult audience. So in the same way that you watch a show like, say, Breaking Bad, or you watch a show like House, and these characters have different foibles because this is written for an adult audience, that's what it was for Sherlock Holmes. He had a cocaine problem. Because that was adding, like, I just always thought it was amusing, because the way that they phrased it as well was the fact that he had such a brilliant deductive mind that in his reasoning, he'd be bored if he didn't have a case at hand. So that's why he would take cocaine, would be to stimulate and occupy his mind. Which was just phrased as it was. Yeah, but, you know, it really goes down the line. I mean, I think also I read Dracula as well, which I thought the couple things that struck me about that were, one, again, I think if anybody thinks they're clever by observing that there's a sexual subtext to stories of vampires, has not read Bram Stoker's Dracula, because it is as overt as it could be. I suppose that the language is a little more obfuscating, but it's pretty overt. And then there's also the fact that I guess I didn't realize until I read it in the same way that I read I got the sense that Don Quixote was like the Kick-Ass of its time. But I suppose Dracula was the Paranormal Activity of its time. It was written as these really dry, fake letters of correspondence between the characters, with the dates and all these really mundane details, because it was that felt that it gave a sense of reality, or it was documenting something in a way that a novel with a third person omniscient narrator wouldn't. And so it hit me that, well, that's like seeing found footage, you know, that with right. the means of the time, that was a found footage horror movie. The thing that's also just strikes me about Dracula as well is just the fact that it opens with, it's all about this really, it begins with the most stuffy, almost administrative real estate deal. And there's just so many, you know, because it's about, it opens with Jonathan Harker, and he's traveled to Transylvania to meet with this count who's just interested. He's such an Anglophile. He keeps these brochures about London in his study that he just pours over, and he has all these questions about London because he's interested in buying real estate there. And that's how the whole story gets started.
Hmm. Wow. Now, it sounds to me like these are not going to all be very similar in tone, you know, because this one has sort of the adventures and humor aspects to it, but it sounds like other ones might not necessarily follow the same pattern. You might go a different direction with stuff like Sherlock Holmes or Peter Pan, stuff like that. Is that kind of your intention?
Yeah, the plan is right now is that each one will have a veer more to a different genre, I should say. So this was definitely leaning more to action. I think it was unavoidable to have comedy in it, but I think I would list it as action first. One of the ones that we have planned is more horror, for sure. And then one of them will be leaning more towards comedy, or even more so.
Okay, that'll be good to see, because I like anthologies because they do that. They don't necessarily do exactly the same thing in every story. Certain ones are very different from each other, and I like that because I like variety when I read stuff like that. So for me, as much as I enjoyed this one, I would be disappointed if they were all exactly like this one.
Yeah, well, we're thinking along the same lines. The next one's going to be more horror and more dramatic. But I think the hope is that they're not going to be so disparate that if you like this one, you're not going to like the next one. I think we've kept enough of a unifying voice to the whole thing. But the key is just always going to be is that wherever you think the premise is going to go based on the one-liner that you hear, we get through that within three pages, and then we move on and just keep going from there.
Very cool, very cool. I like the way that you're approaching it thoughtfully, and sometimes anthologies aren't very thoughtful. I get a little discouraged when all the stories are basically the same stories, but they're just changing the characters a little here and there. So I'm glad you're not doing that.
Yeah, that was another pet peeve of mine that there was a period where I actually went through a number of anthology series, like say, like What If, and then like Twilight Zone, and Metal Hurlant, and even some of like there's sometimes that you have like an episodic show like on TV, and it winds up being that if you're not telling a sort of like chapter by chapter serial, what you typically find is that before long, whatever anthology you have has about 5 to 7 basic stories that it just keeps repeating and cycling through over and over. So one thing that we were actually a bit freed from is I think I remember reading, if I didn't read, it was obvious to anybody who was reading What If, that every story had to end in disaster. And I think the reasoning always was that if they gave a better outcome, the readers would ask, why isn't this the mainstream continuity?
Yep.
So I think that's, you know, I didn't get a chance to watch the What If show. I still can't believe there actually is a What If show. It goes to show there's Marvel and Disney are going to leave no stone unturned when it comes to adapting their projects at this point. But I think from what I heard from people who watched it, it was a similar idea that almost they always ended in catastrophe. So that's part of the fun with this is that we're not necessarily tied down by any mandate like that. I wanted to take, Don Quixote is a satire and a tragedy, I suppose, all wrapped up in one. And I still was just, I felt like the ultimate way to skewer that was to give it a positive outlook and to take a tragedy and let the hero win. So that's something that was a lot of fun for me.
Now, let me ask you something, though. I'm curious. Would you possibly bring back, say, Don Quixote or War of the Worlds in another story, like Peter Pan meets Don Quixote or Peter Pan meets the War of the Worlds? Or when you do one, do you kind of feel like you've pretty much done all you want to do with that subject?
I wouldn't rule it out. I wouldn't rule anything out. I think the bigger danger when you're making stories or when you're working as a creator is that your eyes get bigger than your stomach and you get too far ahead of yourself. So I definitely didn't want this to feel like we're just giving you a prologue again, or this is a piece of something where we're going to have the inevitable obvious team up between the characters. I wouldn't rule that out, though. I just say at this stage, I think we want to do more one-offs before we consider flipping the premise too much more. But I, you know, what's always fun to me as a writer is you just give me a premise and at first blush it seems it's impossible to do anything with, and then what excites me so much and really spins my wheels is to get into that and find a way to make that work or to see what happens next. And my hope is that with some of these premises, people will see them like, I have no idea how that interaction could possibly work. And then you read it and it makes more sense than you could have ever expected. So that's what's exciting for me. So even from that end, if I got done with this, with these initial one shots that we have planned, and perhaps I had if the prospect came up of we could do something different with it, I would find that really exciting to explore. But I think I have to take the steps, you know, we have to make sure that these ones are as good as they can be first, because I think, again, there's plenty of times you see in comics where people get an eye on that stage first, and then everything up until that point feels like a prologue, and then it's just not as exciting. And then right. You don't get to that point. And then you have cliffhangers that don't get paid off.
Right. Because sometimes I've seen anthology ones where they take, like, for example, Oz, and they have all these different fictional characters end up in Oz, but the Oz is the continuing thing through all the different stories. Yeah, but might you consider something like that? Like maybe the War of the Worlds starts out with Don Quixote and then goes to Sherlock Holmes or Peter Pan, and would that interest you, or do you think that's kind of something we've seen?
I wouldn't rule anything out at this stage. It's just it's interesting when you bring up Oz, because I have strong opinions about Oz.
Okay.
Well, I grew up by Chittenango, New York, which is it's a small town in upstate New York, or central New York, but they one of their claims to fame is, I believe it was the birthplace of L. Frank Baum.
Oh.
Not where he wrote the books, I think. I think whenever, from what I understand, he moved to California by the time he did that. But they don't let that get in the way. For decades, they've had the Ozfest, which then they renamed. I think it's been so long since I've been in. I know they had to rename it because of some confusion with the Ozzy Osbourne Music Festival. I think it's called.
Oh.
I forgot what it's called now, but they paint the sidewalk yellow. They have a Tinker Tank parade. When I was going to it, they still had the three surviving Munchkins were available for a spaghetti dinner one of the nights. They would have exhibits about Baum's life, and they would also have the books. And I think, again, with the Oz stories, it's fascinating to me how many people seem to have an idea of what the Wizard of Oz was based on just the Judy Garland movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and so for instance, that was a whole bunch of books like that. I think he was releasing like one a year, and it was like, you know, TikTok of Oz and Ozma of Oz. And something that I remember when I read the original one, and this is something that's has always been kind of a pet peeve of mine, I think, with comics too, is that you'll have a comic that's the sales point is to say, we're doing Dark Oz. It's not like that movie you watch. And I'm like, right. So Oz. Because if you actually read the book, you know, the Tin Woodsman becomes who he is because his axe blade keeps falling off and hacking off his limbs by accident. And then when they fight the Wicked Witch of the West sends crows after them, and he dispatches them by chopping them up. It's always fascinating to me that you'll often it strikes me that the people who tend to say, oh, you know, today's fiction is more crass or darker than it used to be, are also the first ones to be really blown away when you see some articles saying with the thesis of, did you know how dark The Wizard of Oz actually was in the book? So, that's the aspect of it that I just it just strikes me that I'm not sure the sales hook of this seems to be based on not quite what you're referring to. Like it's already pretty dark. I mean, and again, to my point, it was like when you read Peter Pan. Peter Pan's pretty Freudian. When you read the Sherlock Holmes story, like he has a cocaine problem. Like those are not modern additions to make it darker. I think these things are actually more consistent than you would think. So, right. With Oz, I don't know. I I kind of had a personal rule to myself at a certain point that I was not really interested in ever having. I had a personal like prohibition in my own work that I would have no quotes or paraphrasings of quotes from the Wizard of Oz movie, because I just think there's, you know, it's like, we're not in Kansas anymore, or we're not in Gotham anymore, or we're not in, we're not in New York anymore. You know, it just, it seemed a little tired. And it's always, what gets me about it is I feel like it winds up like a game of telephone, that those feel not as fresh just because the people aren't going from the source. It's like that whole game of, you know, what they said, when you're writing a research paper, you need to get first-hand sources, not second-hand or third-hand. And so that was something that we were pretty committed to when we were making this. I mean, also the fact that if you go through it, I mean, I hope it makes an impression on readers, because we did put some effort into it, but we tried to make the locations accurate to Spain and the monuments accurate to Spain of that era.
Well, it sounds like you put a lot of effort and thought into all these good things, because it really shows it, I think. It's really going to be something special as they go forward. Now, the question I have for you, if people want to order the book, how do they do it?
Go to Kypsel, which is Kypsel, and you'll be easy to find it there. It's available all over the world in different currencies, and you can just pay for it there or download it. What's actually cool about the platform as well, I'm not sure if I mentioned this before already because we've had such a spirited talk, but there is an innovative sales model that the site has, where once you buy the book, you can actually then go on and sell it to friends, and you get a percentage of the of what it's sold for. So I'd say it's like engaging our readers to become a street team, and to also, we figured word of mouth is really the most powerful way that I think any title builds its notoriety. And we figured, that was always Kypsel's design. But when they explained it to me, I thought it made a lot of sense, was to, you know, incentivize that. If, you know, who's going to be your biggest advocate than somebody who enjoyed what you made. And I think the other aspect of it as well that's cool is, you know, you've seen different iterations of this, that when things have been going to digital, I think we wind up losing some of the fun of having physical media, right? I mean, you know, you used to trade your collection with somebody who was a friend of yours, or maybe you went to like a yard sale or, you know, a flea market or what have you. And some of that was kind of part of the fun, was diving into a back issue bin and not being sure what you find, or even having a conversation with somebody where they could recommend that to you. I mean, that's the thing that I always loved about going to a comic store, was just getting the recommendations. And, you know, and that can be lost. And I think that was part of that's another aspect of what this approach to sales is trying to get at, is bringing that back. You know, even though it is digital, is there a way that we can perhaps recapture some of what surrounded physical media?
Great. Sounds really terrific. Now, if people want to keep up with what you're up to, how do they do that on social media?
Well, I'm on Twitter. It's my name. It's at Tom Penchuk. I've been leaning more into my newsletter on Substack lately, which is called the Chuck Chronicles. It's a funny name, like my last name, but it's spelled C-H-U-K Chronicles. And I've just been spending more time on there lately, because I have the hardest time trying to boil down my my rambling thoughts into just a tweet or a post that has certain constrictions on it, if you haven't been able to tell from this interview. So what I love about Substack is I can go into as much detail as I'd like, and I can go into it feels more substantial to me, and that's something that's really more to my speed. Lately, I've actually been talking, this would probably be fun for anybody who's been a fan of Andy Zenon. I actually went on a road trip and sold copies of the book from our print run directly to stores. And at this count, we're over 40, I want to say getting close to 50 at this point.
Wow.
Which I was I felt pleased about, because I think like Bad Idea maybe didn't maybe had 150. I remember I saw some counts, so I like to think that as a one man street team, I did pretty well. It was just something that we got the print run in for the book, and it was never really intended for a distributor. I think everything got disrupted over these past 2 years because of COVID, and so I had a bunch of books. I didn't have a plan to get it to a distributor, so I decided I'd roll up my sleeves, get in my car, put some boxes in the back, and just go door to door.
Wow.
In every store in multiple areas.
Pretty cool. And I can tell you a quick story about something like that. I'm an editor on a indie comic, and the writer and creator and I were traveling back from a convention up in the Baltimore area, and we stopped at these two stores that like faced each other on the street, and we went into the one store and we were talking, and then my friend the writer, he mentioned the name of the book, and the girl behind the counter, her head shot up and she ran around and she threw her arms around him. "That's my favorite comic," she goes.
Oh, wow.
And so something like that, you know, he came back and he still remembers that, you know, as something that encouraged him to keep going and doing that. And it's nice to get some kind of positive feedback like that.
What's the name of the comic?
It's called Stabbity Bunny.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's at Scout, right?
Right. Right, that's it. Yeah, Richard Rivera is the name of the writer, and he was the one that was there. And the two of us were surprised. At first, I was all worried. Why is she running around the counter after him?
Yeah, I've had, I think especially coming out of quarantine or with varying degrees of it, I really miss the unpredictability of human interaction. So it was really wonderful just going from store to store, and I think there was a real variety of types of stores and a variety of managers as well and different personalities. And I really, you know, welcomed it just walking in and you know, taking in the atmosphere and, you know, having a conversation with somebody about the book. And so it was interesting actually, because there was one store that I went to where the guy actually knew the book ahead of time, which I couldn't believe. And that was because we'd actually, he was a judge at the Eisners, and he'd remembered it from when I submitted it for consideration. So
wow.
Good to know that I was actually seen. But yeah, it was, I've written a bit about that, like in the newsletter. I honestly found it probably one of the best experiences of my life, just because, you know, you have something that you're really proud of, and then you just kind of go on this tour just to show it off to everybody. And what I was really, impressed with was just the fact that I ran into some stores, that had been around for decades, or maybe they were a chain and they were these big chains. And I also ran into some smaller boutiques, and I ran into stores that had actually managed to open during the pandemic despite all odds. And that was really inspiring. And
Great. And
what I realized actually while I was doing it was I was doing something that I had never done, and I don't think anybody as a comics reader had ever done, which was just explore every store beyond my local store. Because I think how it usually works, and of course it's going to work that way, is that you find your local store, whichever one's most convenient to you, and that's the one that you go to. But you don't venture beyond once you've found what works. But in this case, I really made a point to do it. It gave me a much better sense of the industry than I think I would have had. I think definitely what stuck out to me more than anything was I think that the blogosphere tends to have a sensationalist and gloomy view of the industry than is accurate. That's really what I found was there were the number of times that it didn't even have to be a major metropolitan region that I went to, and there were more stores than I could physically attend. Like I couldn't go to. And what I thought to myself was, well, I don't know what a quote unquote like healthier industry would look like if there were more stores. Like I wouldn't be able to go to there would just be more stores I couldn't go to. And there was, you know, there were just wonderful, just great stories of the whole trip. I think one thing that really struck me was just the fact that sometimes I would go to a store that had been around for 40 years and they guess were so well established they didn't need to have any web presence whatsoever.
Wow,
that was the craziest part. Was there were some that they had a phone number and that was it. You know, they did not have a social media site. They did not have a website. They didn't even have an email sometimes. And because they had just been working with these direct subscriptions. But what was wonderful was I would talk to these owners and they would be receptive to my book. They would buy a bunch of copies and they want them signed. So that was really, great. I just think especially because there's been so many editorials that to my mind, are unfair to retailers. It's something in comics journalism where they tend to castigate a store like that as, you know, quote unquote behind the times. And I think, you know, going back to your earlier question, like I just believe that there are different types of audiences, and I think it's, you know, whatever you do best, whether as a retailer or a creator, is about serving that audience. And so if there's some people who, you know, that's the way they love to get comics, I don't think that, I think that's great. I think that's a great thing. And there's another store that might be really, you know, plugged in and up to date. And that's just as good too, because it's found its audience. But I don't think necessarily trying to make one like the other or vice versa is a road to success.
Well, it's like the two stores that we went to, one of them was very comic-oriented and had almost no statues or any of the other stuff. The other one across the street had almost all statues, some comics, but mostly they were they did comic-related items rather than the comics. And that was kind of an interesting – I figured that's how they got along.
Yeah, I ran into something it's funny you say that, because I ran into that twice. I wouldn't have thought that would be as a common occurrence, but I ran into two stores that were on the same block.
And wow.
And even in one case, actually, they were facing each other. And they had this actually, like, you couldn't help but raise the subject of it. And they wouldn't even call it a friendly rivalry, because they just got along so well. And they you know, one store, I think, focused more on trade paperbacks and stuff that was in the back catalog, and the other one focused on new issues, and that's how they had this kind of symbiosis. So that was something that was crazy to see too. But what I liked about it was that's a story I can tell now that I wouldn't have if not for just deciding to hit the road and go out there and you know, pound the pavement and press the flesh, as they say.
Do you ever get to conventions?
I do. I was at Comic-Con this year. It worked out that I was looking at my schedule this year, and I just didn't have every weekend that there was a convention I might have gone to, I had a conflict.
Oh.
So I used to go to probably about 7 or 9 per year. And, you know, I might go back. I think Comic-Con this year was very much like kind of dipping your toe back in the pool for a lot of people. But, you know, I think probably by next year fingers crossed, I think things might have resettled back to that. I certainly love going to conventions. It's just like I said, I think there are some creators who they don't like crowds, they don't like the noise. I just soak it up. I like it all. I like to see people and interact with people. It's just it happened that my schedule this year wasn't going to conflict. I think I've also lately have started running into the issue of that if you're making projects, it's hard to split your time as much. Like I used to, you know, a convention I may have gone for all 3 days before, now I maybe only go for one just because I have deadlines to take care of.
Right, right. Well, that makes sense. Well, that's great though. Well, we'll have to keep up and see what comes out. We'll have to talk again next time you got a project coming out.
Absolutely.
We can talk about.
Yeah, without saying too much, Nikos and I already, we have something brewing. So, and I have some other projects, in the works as well, but I'm always just careful not to get too far ahead of myself. Especially with Andy Xenon, where we ran into delays because of supply chain and then a paper shortage. I hate to say something is coming, then have to do another update saying, well, we're a little behind on when we said it would come out. But that there's more stuff in the works. You'll be seeing more of me for sure.
Well, it'll be great. We'll look forward to it.
Very good.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's always great to talk with Nandor Schaefer, the creator of such wonderful thing as Seasons, and now has a new book called Man-Child Number 1 and 2, which is coming out on Kickstarter right now. So how's it going, Nandor?
It's going really well, Wayne. Happy to be here, and can't wait to talk about Man-Child and everything I've been working on.
Now, people get mad at me because I tend to be behind as to when I say when the project's going to end. The Kickstarter is going to be funded if it reaches its goal by Saturday, October 1st at 8:08 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So I'm going to get that going because people get mad at me. I don't do it soon enough for them. So we're going to get that going. So talk about what Man-Child is about. What's the where did the book come from?
Man-Child came about through my own personal grieving process after Stan Lee had passed away in 2018. I never got to meet Stan Lee, but his imprint, you know, has been on everything I've loved when it comes to superheroes and comic book storytelling. And after he died, I just had this drive, this passion to want to do something in honor of him and to kind of tip my hat to his legacy and what he's given me and given the world. And so that's where the germ of the idea came from, wanting to do something for him. But I didn't want to do just like a vintage book or just an homage book where I'm just sort of playing with the genre. I wanted to, of course, kind of put my own spin on it, my own flavor, if you will, to that sort of book. And it evolved into this story where I'm telling two stories at the same time with this series. And the one takes place in the real world with our main character, Rufus Boston, who is this super nerd, this super comic book geek who hangs out with his friends at the comic book store and goes to see the new superhero film at the midnight showing at his local theater. And just that relatable character and that person who's really obsessed with comics and in the comic itself, this world's version of Stan Lee, who I dubbed Stu Leeds, geniusly enough, if you couldn't tell who that was referring to. But he dies in the comic, and Rufus is just heartbroken and really shocked at this passing. And that's where we find him at the beginning of the story. And then at the same time, we have this Silver Age inspired superhero story going on with the Monarch Crier as he battles his arch nemesis, Professor Pilgrim. And the mystery behind this series is how the two stories relate, you know, why you're reading them at the same time. You know, is this just a fantasy that Rufus has concocted? Is it a childhood hero that he loved growing up? You know, like, how does this character fit in his world, and how does Rufus fit in this character's world? And so I wanted to bridge reality and fantasy and kind of have a commentary on comic book fandom and masculinity and just that escapism and how we all kind of yearned for that, and how you know, our heroes never die, but in the real world they do. And so, you know, with superheroes, they live on and they live on, and or if they die, they come back, you know? So, right. It's really just about that and exploring what makes superheroes, and especially the legacy of where we've come from, you know, from where we are, like, how did we get here? And the era, that lightning in the bottle, trying to capture that, what Stan and Jack and Ditko and all those great creators did at the time.
Okay, now the one thing that got me was, and I had to look this up, you have a Bible verse at the beginning of I think, is this the beginning of chapter 2 or Man-Child
2? It is,
two?
Yeah, issue 2, yeah.
It's got a Bible verse that I wasn't familiar with. It's 1 Corinthians 13:11. So I had to look it up, and I thought I would go ahead and, just in case somebody doesn't know what it is, be able to talk about it and tell you what the verse is. In the New King James Version, it says, "When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. And I'm just curious, how does that verse impact the story you're telling?
Well, it's definitely food for thought. I wanted to put that as the title for the second issue because I wanted people to investigate it, and I wanted people to ask the question you're asking right now. And something that I've experienced as I've gotten older, and I've seen my friends go through this, and just people in the world seeing, you know, people who've loved video games and comic books and these fantasies, and you know, especially when it comes to like these genres that and these mediums that we love and adore as kids. As you grow older, it seems to those things seem to fade as you get older. Their importance seem to fade sometimes, you know, and for some people, they feel like they have to let go of those things to be a man, or, you know, to become a man or woman, you know, and, you know, become an adult, like grow up. And so I thought that verse was very fitting for the story I'm trying to tell and the themes I'm trying to hit on and point out, because in the context of that verse, it's sort of talking about growing in a spiritual sense rather than in the things that you enjoy. But I thought it would just be fitting for this story thematically.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of cool. Now, see, the funny thing to me is that there are some things that even as we become adults, we still hold on to, seems to me.
Correct. Yeah.
I remember, it's funny, there's a movie, they're going to see a movie. It's called The Mighty Upholders 4.
Yeah.
And it reminded me when the first Avengers movie was coming out.
Right.
And I was in a grocery store, and there was a guy that worked there, and he was moving stuff around. And one of his friends came up to him and said, "Are you going to go see the Avengers movie?" Mm-hmm. And he said, "Yeah." He says, "I got to go see it because I've never seen them in live action before. So I've got to go see it." And I thought, that's interesting. I thought, what's that going to mean as far as like when the other movies come out?
Yeah, right.
But as far as I know, he still went to see them all. And so there are a lot of... You know, the funniest thing is because I grew up as a fan of Batman. Mm-hmm. And, of course, his last name is my first name. And so I kind of related to him. You know, I also relate to characters who can become heroes by themselves. They don't have a magic power ring. They don't have a radioactive spider bite them and stuff like that.
Right.
I like characters who are like... you know, Batman, who can work their way into becoming a hero somehow. Mm-hmm. If I worked hard and somehow I got a lot of money, I could be Batman if I were in my head. So the trick of it is, as far as other things to me, you know, my brother was big on Superman, although I thought, I'm not from another planet. So yeah. I'm not vulnerable. So that doesn't really... it reminded me of all these things when I was looking at the book. And are you one of the characters in this book?
No. I mean, I'm definitely taking from things that I've experienced in my own life and things that I've seen my friends go through. Some of the conversations in this story are like actual conversations I've had with other comic book fans. Specifically, the interaction that one of the characters, Augie, one of Rufus's best friends, has with a guy at the theater who is waiting to see a movie. Augie comes up to him and asks, like, "Oh, are you here to see The Mighty Upholders 4? And the guy's like, "No, I'm actually here to see the new My Tiny Horsey," which is like our version of My Little Pony. And Augie's like, "Okay, that's kind of weird. You know, this grown man is going to see this new My Little Pony movie. And, you know, the Brony fan base was like a huge thing. And I probably still is, but I haven't heard much of it. But that interaction right there was actually something that happened to me at a theater. I was going to see a new superhero movie, and this guy was seeing the new My Little Pony movie. I thought he was there to see like the new superhero movie. And, you know, I was inadvertently like judging him, you know, but then I was like, well, I'm going to see this superhero movie. Like, you know, what like is, you know, are they different? You know, does it make it different? And so there are, like I said, conversations and things that happen in the series that I kind of pulled from, because they were just really great, I think, talking points and interesting interactions that I've had with people. And I sort of wanted to bring that to light, because I've always kind of wanted to bring all of my love for what I've grown up with in terms of comics and superheroes and grow up with them, you know. And I've never wanted that to fade away, and I've seen it fade away in people that I know. And it's sort of sad in a way, because I feel like that's such a big part of my identity, and I want people to hold on to it and celebrate it. And I don't think 25 years ago, we didn't really have the phenomenon of the MCU and all the movies and TV shows that we have now. And I think back then there was definitely more of a stigma than there is now. And so I find that shift when it comes to what's acceptable as you grow up and what you can enjoy and what people won't judge you for anymore. Because, you know, I meet those people that are like, yeah, I kind of stopped collecting comics like when I met my girlfriend, or when I, you know, hung around with this group of friends, like it wasn't really cool anymore to enjoy those things. And so, I wanted to kind of capture that as much as I could.
That's funny you say that, because when I grew up, I was in the opposite circumstance. My brother and I were the only ones in the whole region, it seemed like, who bought comics and read comics. And people used to kind of make fun of us because of that. And the interesting thing is, now in my hometown, there's an actual artist who draws comics living there.
Wow, that's so cool.
I find that so interesting. And the fact that here's this guy, he's making a living off of drawing comics, and it's in the hometown where everybody made fun of me. See, now, other things that that I find when I go through like Facebook and other stuff and other social media, mm-hmm. I run across people that I knew when I was growing up and who made fun of us watching superhero movies.
Yeah.
And sometimes I ask them, did you go see the latest superhero? Oh, yeah, I loved that movie. I thought that was a great movie. And I'm kind of going, you know, we were on the train a lot earlier than you were.
Yeah, I know. It almost, you're almost like, not like gatekeeping in a way, but it's like, you're like, hey, I was here first, you know? And you know, this is more important to me than it is to you, because, you know, you guys had to catch up.
That's why I wanted to tell them you're late on the train. I was on the train a lot sooner than you were, but that's funny about that. But I always look at that stuff and I just have to smile to myself. I don't want to make a big deal out of it.
Right. But I hear you.
It's so interesting to me how all these people who made fun of this stuff now are big fans of it, because it's a big movie and stuff like that.
Yeah, now it's cool.
Yeah, I get a huge kick out of it. I mean, all these thoughts were in when I started to read the book, because I remembered all this stuff. Now, the reason I asked that question is because one of the characters' name is Condor Archer.
Yeah.
And your name, of course, being Nandor Schaefer, I thought, gee, is that, was that a play on your name?
That's funny. That's funny you bring that up. It definitely sounds similar, but I actually chose that name, Condor Archer. It's an analog to like Hawkeye, but Stan Lee actually created a character called the Condor, which was a animated movie that came out in the early 2000s when I was growing up. And so it's sort of a nod to that. But yeah, it definitely sounds similar.
Yeah, that's what I thought was going on with that. I thought maybe that was you. It sounded similar, but okay. That does. Now let's talk about the man child, the character, the superhero.
Yeah.
When I was, I read the first issue I got, and it didn't dawn on me until I was looking at the pages that are on the Kickstarter page. And I realized, Stanley had a big hand in the creation of Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And this character, Manchild, actually has like a butterfly get up. And I thought, oh, instead of a spider, it's a butterfly character. Is that the way that you approach this character?
Yeah, I mean, Spider-Man is definitely, I think, Stan Lee's, most well-known creation. And so when I was thinking about the superhero character that I wanted for the story, I knew I wanted it to be an insect, of some kind. And I chose the monarch butterfly because a few reasons. One is thematically, it kind of is, I think, the best choice for like transformation, metamorphosis, that idea of growing from a young boy to a man and sort of that coming of age feel. And so I wanted that. That was the reason it was like a good fit, but also butterflies are definitely my most favorite insect. And then also it seems so kind of silly that there'd be a butterfly hero, because it's like, okay, what, butterflies aren't threatening. They really, they don't have any, they don't bite necessarily or do anything that's really, on the offense. And so it had this underdog appeal to me, where it just really fit all of these dimensions of what I wanted. And he, the costume and the character really was an amalgamation of Spider-Man, definitely, but also a little bit of Black Bolt. And that really comes into play with his vocal apparatus that he has around him. He uses that to emit like these sonic screams, or these shouts of kind of rage, and it sends back the opponents and the enemies. And then some Ant-Man there as well, with like the antenna. And he is a biochemist. And so his name's George Jeffrey. He's a biochemist. And so it has all of these little ingredients that kind of formed some of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's creations at the time, sort of at the onset of what became Marvel Comics and that Marvel age of comics. So yeah, definitely tried to pull from like my favorite classic superheroes. And you see the Spider-Man and like the eyes and him being an insect, and some of those pages specifically in issue 2 that you see there on the Kickstarter page. There's definitely a lot of Spider-Man in those pages. I was really reminded of like older Spider-Man comics when I got the art back from Jay Mazar. He just did an incredible job and really captures that style. And so I'm glad you felt that when you saw them.
Now, what's interesting to me, of course, he's called Monarch Crier. And I was trying to think how that related to Spider-Man, but you're right. That has to do with his power. Mm-hmm. The sonic kind of things. And I got a kick at the beginning of the movie. We see that the villain is saying no retort, which is kind of a Spider-Man-ish thing. Spider-Man is jumping around and doing all kinds of stuff, but at the same time, he's cracking wise and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I got a kick. So here's this situation where he's referring to him and saying to him why is there no retort kind of stuff.
Right. And yeah. So no back, backhand comment or sarcastic reply,
Yeah. Now, what's the name of the villain that we see in the movie?
So he is Professor Pilgrim is his name. And he is the arch enemy. He's basically our Victor Von Doom, our Red Skull, our Magneto. He's really the most vilest of villains, but he also has this kind of sympathetic undertone to him as you learn more about him and his story. And so you really get to see his perspective on things and why he's doing what he's doing.
It's interesting because at one point he comes across a great big robot.
Yeah. So that is a creation of Professor Pilgrim's. And it's this huge like behemoth of a robotic figure. I going into the second issue when I was scripting it, I really want these superhero battles and these superhero moments told in this classic style. I really want it to make people feel like they're reading, you know, a comic from the 60s. And I was like, we need a giant robot like that. That's something that is really important that we need in this story. And the design choice for it kind of comes from like Terminus and like the Sentinels from the X-Men and some other characters from that era too.
Yeah. It's really kind of cool. I have to say that the art is really good. It's very classic Marvel style, which I really like.
Jay is amazing. He does it all. He does the pencils, inks, and colors himself.
Wow. Okay. That's hard to find. Usually in these days, people either draw or color.
Yeah.
But not the two of them.
Correct. Definitely a one-man army in that respect, and kind of the complete package. He has a really good color sense in it, and it I really like the way, you know, it has those flat colors where nothing's too layered, and it has that classic feel to it.
Yeah, because nowadays, you know, people are looking at the angle. Where does the light come from? And that alters the color, how it looks,
right?
You know, on the shadings and stuff like that. So it's kind of fun to see how this all goes. Now they're watching the movie, right? Is what's going on. So we see the two things. We're actually watching them watch the movie. And how do you keep the two storylines straight as far as that goes?
Yeah. Well. What's kind of a trick that I learned early on as I was putting the series together was, you know, trying to find ways where I could transition from one story to the next. And one way you can do that, I found, was page turns. You know, as you turn the page, you can kind of enter into a new scene, you know, a new world. And so that's definitely present in the series and with these two issues that we have on Kickstarter. And so there's that. And specifically with this scene, they're, you know, about to watch this movie and we turn the page and it's like, even the narration says we're in for an alternative show, you know, and that is where we left off at the end of issue one for the Monarch Crier. And we see where he is held captive on Professor Pilgrim's Island, this mysterious island that he has taken over. So it was one of the most rewarding aspects of writing the series was how to divvy up the stories, you know, on how much space to give each one, and have it not be too jarring, like going from one to the next. And so I tried to find the best cliffhangers for the way scenes would end, and make use of the page turns so that when you turn the page, you would sort of move from one story to the next.
It reminded me, whenever I go to a movie theater, the good movies make me forget I'm in a theater.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The bad ones remind me that I'm in a
theater. Yeah, like, why am I here?
I was watching one of the Rocky movies. He was in the Soviet Union, tell you how old this movie is. And he was there, and he's fighting this guy, he's pumped up full of steroids and all this kind of stuff. And in the middle of the whole thing, he knocks the Soviet guy to the ground. And they push an open microphone in his face. Mm-hmm. And knowing what I know about the Soviet Union, that would never happen. And so all of a sudden, whoop, I'm sitting in a movie theater going, oh rats, yeah. I said. I'm out of the movie and I'm not enjoying it anymore.
Yeah.
So that's what I noticed, that transition happens in here. They go into the theater and then the movie starts up and we can see people watching it, and then it transitions into the movie.
Right. Yeah.
So we get that. So you're using that whole experience whole thing to move us into the film. So I like that very much about that I got that experience. It reminded me of movies that I've really enjoyed that just make me forget where I am.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, that's the thing about, you know, whether you get so absorbed in a movie or a comic, you know, you do forget where you are. It's almost like I don't want to say like hypnosis, but you're just really mesmerized and taken into this other world, and that's when you get the most out of it, and you're transported. And so that was definitely the intent there.
It reminds me very much of what Frank Miller once said. He saw a Batman comic and he picked it up and he opened it. And he fell in, was the description he used.
Yeah,
he was not in it, and then he fell into it, and now he was living inside the comic book while he was reading it. I always use that as a great example for that. So it's really kind of cool. So Man-Child number 2, how many pages is in this issue?
It's going to be 24 pages of story and art, and then there'll be some few extra pages. I'm actually running a fan art contest for this book. And so one of the pages there is going to be a fan art piece that is voted into it. And then I would love to do actually like a letters page in the book as well. So where people could send in what they thought of the first issue and what their expectations are for the series. But 24 pages of story and art, and then 28 pages altogether.
Okay, so that's going to be kind of cool. Now, the thing I'm interested in is how many issues are going to be in the Man-Child series?
So it's going to be a limited series. It's going to be 6 issues altogether, and I have them all scripted out, actually.
Oh, wow. Great. Now, is the same artist going to work on all of them?
Yes, yeah. Jay is on board for all of it. He's really excited to continue with the series, and he's having a great time with it. So he wants to do it all. So that's really encouraging.
Great, great. So it's going to be kind of fun to see. Now Chris, the name of the hero is
Monarch Crier. Yeah.
Monarch Crier. That's right. But, and yet the name of the book is Man-Child.
Yeah.
Is Man-Child we see a cover and it shows Rufus coming through the door. Is Rufus the Man-Child?
He is. He's definitely the main character in that respect. It's also, the Monarch Crier has the name starts with, both an M and a C. And so Man-Child, Monarch Crier, also Marvel Comics is sort of why I chose it. Kind of alludes to that and alludes to Rufus being, a man-child. And, what does that mean, necessarily? And is that a good or bad thing? I wanted to sort of take that term, take that word and turn it on its head and make people think is he attacking fandom, or is he celebrating it? What is he doing with this book? And so I wanted to make that just the title, because I felt like it represented what I wanted to do with the book itself and what was going on with it.
That's pretty cool. Pretty inventive as far as that goes, to tie the people looking in, and particularly Rufus and his friends, into what's going on with the film. That's really something special, because, like I said, I've seen so many movies where I go and I'm literally lost in the film and I forget what I'm saying. And so that's why I get that sense from this as well. So that's
great.
That's
Thank you.
Very cool. Now, this is the again, I'm going to mention that the project will be funded if it reaches its goal by Saturday, October 1st at 8:08 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I like to mention that a couple of times because some people may not be paying attention the first time. So we did that. So you've got a lot of interesting pledge levels. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to say, of course, one of the great things about Kickstarter, if you missed the first issue, you can still get the first issue as well as the second issue in the Kickstarter.
Correct. Yeah. And you can also get all of the variant covers that were on offer for the first issue as well as add-ons. So for the first issue, we had Tony Harris, Nick Patara, Tom Riley, and Welby, all Marvel and DC artists who are working in the industry. And so if there are any variant covers from the first issue that people missed out on, you can get some really gorgeous, gorgeous work there too.
Now, one of the things, if you pledge $50 or more, you get your name in the acknowledgments.
Yeah, yeah, you do.
That's kind of it. You also get the Manchild 2 PDF, the standard cover, and an exclusive art print as well. So I thought that was kind of an interesting way to get people to get their names in there, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. I really love doing the acknowledgments. I've done it with all of my previous books, and it's a very popular tier. I think people like feeling like they're a part of it because they are. You know, I mean, really, this wouldn't exist without others. And I wanted to reward people for pledging at that level as much as I could. And the thing about, you know, Kickstarter too is trying to give people their money's worth and make them feel like they're getting a really great deal and that they're helping create something with me. And so having that sense of ownership, I think, is a great way to get people on board.
Now, one of my very favorite levels, and unfortunately I never can afford this, as you pledge $150 or more, you get drawn into Manchild.
Yeah.
Now, yeah. That means not all the pages are completely done.
Right, yeah. So there's room for us to squeeze some people in. For the first issue, we had two or three people who pledged at that level, and so they're in the first issue itself, and one of them even got a few lines in the comic where they got to speak to Rufus. So that was pretty cool. I really like doing that. And yeah, we're thinking, you know, people that pledge at that level, we can put them in the movie theater or, you know, throughout the book and or in the Monarch Crier storyline, you know, you can have these different people in there. So I love offering that one.
I never can afford it. There was only one time when I had the money and that level was something I could afford.
Yeah.
It was in a book that was about a zombie Moby Dick.
Mm.
It was a book. And I ended up being one of the crew on the ship.
Oh, that's so cool.
And, you know, of course, I normally wear glasses. And so when I was looking through the book trying to find myself, I couldn't recognize myself. So I asked the guy, I said, where am I? And he said, oh, you're there, but you don't have glasses on because they didn't wear glasses back then. I went, oh, okay. And there I was standing there, and I got a huge kick out of that. I saved that one because, you know, I think every fan, if we could only afford it, would get in ourselves drawn into comics as many as we could.
Yeah.
So I got a kick out of that. I loved seeing that, and that was just a wonderful thing. And nobody, as we're talking, nobody has signed up for that one yet. I hope people do, because that's a lot of fun. That's one of my very favorite levels in Kickstarter projects.
Yeah. Well, the tier above that, where you get the original art, it actually includes being drawn into the story. And I think there's been one or two people who's pledged at that level. So there will be already a couple people in the book, but that's sort of even more of an incentive as you get higher into the rewards on Kickstarter for this campaign. You get all of the previous rewards. For $200, you could get an original page from the comic drawn into it, an ink sketch, and get your name in the book and all of that fun stuff.
Oh, people do that. Well, two people, as we're talking, maybe it changed by the time it posts, but two backers, and you still had three left out of the five for the original art, and then it
yeah.
drawn in and stuff like that. Are they going to be people in the theater? Is that where they're going to likely be?
Probably. I think that would just be the most reasonable place to put them, but you know, with the crowd. But there are a few other scenes in the issue that I have in mind where we could put a few people. So, yeah, there's definitely room for different spots.
So if you don't have all the artwork done, obviously, then. So when will the book be finished, Man-Child number 2, and ready for people to get?
Yeah, so it should be finished and ready for the printer, I would say, by the end of the year at the latest. And then we should have the second issue in early next year. So that's how it was for the first book. And I think Jay and I and our letterer, DC Hopkins, have a better idea of scheduling than we did the last time around. So I think it'll be a little quicker than the first book.
Okay, that'll be fun to see, because I like those kinds of things. I like it when it comes. Now, does this come out? I'm trying to remember how often this comes out. Is it like once a year, or is it once every 6 months?
Yeah, so so far it's just been once a year. You know, I did the first campaign last year, and the first book came out, and then doing this campaign this year with the second book. And so I would love to speed it up. I'd love to do actually a few issues a year. And that's something that I'm going to try to do next year if I can. It's just a lot of time running the campaigns and putting everything together. But hopefully I can do more a year. I would really like to, because I don't want people waiting too long, and I don't want people to forget, you know, like what's happened in between issues, because it's just such a important story to me, and I want people to be able to experience it in the best way possible.
Okay, because it's something good to do, because we're very patient as fans if you tell us when things are going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
I always talk about the Dark Knight experience. The you know, Frank Miller did the first issue right on schedule. Second issue came out right on schedule. Third issue came out 6 months mm-hmm. after that. And then the final issue, the fourth one, came out a year after that.
Oh my goodness. I did not know that. That is
Well, I lived through it. So I was afraid I wasn't going to get to see the end of that story.
Oh, you know,
I was like, Mr. Miller, please, let's get busy here.
Yeah.
It's taking so long. And I never forget the day it came out, and I went home, and I had a roommate who wasn't into comics. And there I am sitting there going, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh. And he goes, why are you so interested? I said, I never thought I'd get to read this book. So now I get to read it, and I was so happy about that. But, you know, see, that's the thing. Nowadays with social media and stuff like that, it's easier to let people know, look, you know, especially with paper shortages, and the trouble we're having with the scheduling and the interacting of all the different things. As long as you keep us up to date and stuff, we're usually pretty agreeable to those kinds of things. As long as we know, if like I said with that one, I had no idea, because of that time, social media wasn't a big, hadn't happened yet, so I had no idea if that was ever gonna.
I can't even imagine what that would have been like, because you're just sitting there going, it's been a year, you know, and no information.
And I had no idea. That was the thing. Was nobody said when it was going to come out. And just 1 week, there it was. And I was like, oh, it's finally here. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. But, it's better now, because we have social media, and it lets us know.
Right.
What's going on. So I'm always very happy about that. And like I said, when people know, it makes a big difference as far as, you know, how we deal with that. But it's like when people know, people binge watch television.
Yeah.
You know, you sit and watch a whole season at one time. And when I was growing up and when I was early adulthood, I never got that experience. I'd always have to watch a week, and then you watch that one. Then a week later, another episode would come, and then we'd have to wait another week. And so week after week, it took time.
Yeah.
And I watched these people. I sat and talked with some people who binge shows. I said, what was your experience like? So, well, I got to watch the whole thing in one day. I was like, what?
Yeah.
I never got to do that. And that's something I never have done. Although nowadays with Cobra Kai, I got to watch the fifth season in 2 days. We watched half and half and stuff like that. But see, this is a different experience for me. I'm not used to that. I'm used to waiting for a week. And I get together with friends and we say, what do you think is going to happen next week? Oh, I don't know. It could be this. It could be that.
Yeah,
and now, of course,
more of that anticipation and the theorizing and all of that. And,
trying to figure it out.
Yeah. And it's interesting because you notice how, like, since people are used to that now, it's weird when streaming shows will do the week to week. Like when Kenobi was coming out, and it's like, oh, we have to wait every week for this new show. And it's like, we're so spoiled because it's like we want it all to be on there, you know, all together. And so it's hard, you know, it's hard when some services give you all of that and then some kind of hold it back. And yeah, it's like, I don't think people realize that this is actually the way things used to be, you know, all the time.
Now, of course, now you've got time in between your issues. And see, we're used to stuff coming out. Every month, the first week has these issues come out, and the second week is another set of issues. And so I'm used to, like, every month getting that. So I'm having to, here I am binging certain things now all together, and then other things, other comics I'm waiting for, and I don't know when they're going to come out.
Right.
So I'm going like, ah. And the problem is that we also have short attention spans.
Right, yeah.
I always like the Janet Jackson song, What Have You Done For Me Lately? And people kind of go, I haven't seen a book like that from that for a couple. Let me move on to something else. Mm. And that's always a big problem. And so this is why, again, social media and stuff like that is a massive help to comics like that. Now, speaking of which, how do people keep up with what you're doing and how things are coming along?
Yeah, so I try to be everywhere I can, at least where I feel like the most traffic is. And so you can find me on Facebook, Nandra Fox Schaefer, and I usually update people on what I'm doing, what I'm working on there. Also on Instagram, at Nandra Fox Schaefer, and then on Twitter, at Nandra Fox. So you can keep up with all of my process and projects that I'm working on there. I also have a newsletter that I started this year on Substack, foxholecomics.substack.com. People can just look up that and subscribe to it, and you'll get an email from me. I've been trying to do one every 2 weeks or so, and just keep people up to date with what I'm working on, what I'm doing. And then I also have a YouTube channel that I started last year, called Foxhole Comics. And I do live streams where I talk about what I'm working on and kind of share what I'm reading. And I also do videos on certain topics and also share some of my favorite stories. And so everything's very all comic book related. So if anyone's into that or interested, you can find me on all of those places.
Do you mind if I ask you something? Because I'm like, about a year ago, this whole Substack thing hit.
Right.
Like James Tynion IV went over there. He left DC and went to them. And they gave him a boatload of money, to take do his stuff on there. And some people have had a lot of success. Other people, not so much. I was just kind of curious, what has your experience with Substack been?
For me personally, it's been really great. I definitely didn't get an invitation to go over there or anything like that. I've been wanting to do a newsletter for a while, and none of the previous services really felt easy to use to me. There's, too many learning curves for someone like me, and I never really knew where to go. And then when I started seeing everyone go to Substack, I was like, I've never heard of Substack before. Like, what is this? And when I noticed that a lot of comic book writers were going over there, it was like the perfect this light bulb went off in my head where I just thought, okay, so everyone's migrating to this newsletter service. And everyone who had never signed up with Substack before is probably signed up now because of these writers and these creators. So I felt like it was a perfect opportunity for me to kind of put my name in the hat there and hopefully gain some followers. So it was just like one of those right place, right time moments where I didn't have a newsletter. And I saw an opportunity and wanted to make one. And I really love their interface. The way they have everything set up there is so easy, really easy just to navigate and figure out. And I've never seen a newsletter service like this where it just everything is very streamlined and clean. And it's all free to use. You know, I think after, I think maybe like your first 1,000 subscribers, like it's all free. And so I have a couple hundred subscribers on my newsletter. And that's really encouraging to me because I never thought I'd gain that amount. But I think Substack has kind of given creators and specifically comic book writers kind of a place to share their thoughts more and kind of get more of a connection with people and their fans. And, you know, it's different than YouTube too, because there's a lot of people that aren't comfortable with like being in front of a camera. And so I feel like the newsletter side of things helps people that wouldn't normally be doing something like that or being on YouTube. So, but yeah, it's been really good. I've really enjoyed using it so far.
Do you release exclusive content through Substack, or do you keep that?
Yeah, I do. I do. I release like exclusive pages and sneak peeks and previews that you won't see anywhere else. I'm going to be revealing this new science fiction fantasy comic that I've been working on. That'll be something that's exclusive to Substack subscribers. So I definitely have some things in the works that I've been meaning to get people on board, and you'll get some exclusive things through there for sure.
How do you sign up for your newsletter and stuff on Substack?
Yeah, all you got to do is type in foxholecomics.substack.com, and then it'll prompt you to just type in your email, and then you'll be a subscriber. It's super easy. And all you have to do is, yeah, just type in your email right then and there, and you'll be signed up for all of my newsletters and notifications.
That's cool, because every once in a while something hits the comics industry, and I'm never quite sure how it's going to, you know, function.
Right.
There was a comic company that this guy had lots of money, and he lured all of these comics people away. I think it was CrossGen was the name of the company. Mm. And he moved all these people to Florida, and everybody went in there and started doing stuff. You had to have the 8-to-5 schedule. And I think he figured he was going to revolutionize the comics industry. And one day he walked in the office and said, "That's it. No more money. I'm out." No. And I'm always, I hear, like when Substack hit, I was skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, having gone through CrossGen and all these other things where people would come and say, "Now I'm going to fix the comics industry." And then it doesn't take long before they say, "Well, I haven't fixed the comics industry, so I'm out."
Yeah. And, you know, I waited a long time. You know, I waited about a year or like 8 months before I decided to go over there and create a newsletter, you know, because I was skeptical as well. I wanted to see what was going on, you know, like, is this like not a scam, but just like, is this going to fall through? You know, like, is this just a fad phase that's going to kind of dissolve after a time? But the more I saw some of my favorite creators go over there and just fellow indie creators go over there, I was like, huh, it must not be all bad. You know, it must be pretty helpful. So, it was interesting to see that shift, because there's definitely a shift and seeing like people give comics, like exclusive comics out, sometimes for free for people to read. I know like Brian K. Vaughan, his Substack, he's been putting out this, every Monday he puts out a few pages of this graphic novel that he's been working on, and just has it out there for free for people to read. And that is really kind of just unheard of. You know, you don't see people giving out things for free as much. And that really appealed to me because when I started putting out Seasons, I put it out as a webcomic for free for people to read. And so I was like, I really liked that format and kind of giving people something in exchange for, you know, getting in their inbox and being able to communicate with them and touch base with them. So, yeah, it's, I wonder where it'll go. And I wonder if there'll be like more surges or if it'll kind of plateau and kind of even out as we move forward.
We'll find out as time goes forward. Now, one last question for you. Seasons. You did three, as I understand it, three of the seasons. Are you planning on doing a fourth, or have you finished that story?
So actually, there's only been two that's been released so far. Seasons volumes 1 and 2, spring and summer. We are in the process of, I've written all of volume 3. We haven't started the art yet on it, but that's something that we're going to be doing soon. Myself and Anthony Gonzalez-Clark, he's been kind of poking and prodding me to work on it soon. So that's definitely going to be in the works. And yeah, we're going to be working on volume 3 fall here soon. And it's going to be the biggest book yet. Both volumes are over 100 pages. So this third one is going to be even larger than that. So it's going to be an undertaking for sure. There's a lot that goes on in this next book.
Wow. You're going to have to schedule between Manchild and Seasons, sounds like.
Yeah. It's difficult. And then that science fiction fantasy book I've been working on too, I'm trying to juggle everything and kind of see how I can manage all of these books at the same time. But it's been really rewarding creatively and trying to, as a writer, I think it's important to show your range and to try to have multiple projects that you can juggle, because I think that's just what it means to be a writer. And so I've sort of tried to prepare myself in that way. And I can always write faster than the artist can draw. So I think it's important to not just sit and wait, but try to write other things and new things and see what resonates with people.
Yeah. And of course you can write one sentence and it'll be a whole page. The building exploded. And then you're done with that page, but the artist has got a whole lot more work to do.
Yeah. I feel very, like, I don't feel like a writer sometimes when that happens. Am I actually doing my job here? But there, I make up for it with some other pages where I'm like, I probably did too much there. But yeah, it just depends on the page and the day, I guess.
Well, Nando, it's all great stuff. I've really enjoyed your material. I'm looking forward to reading more of your stuff. And once again, I just want to make sure everybody knows this project will be funded if it reaches its goal by Saturday, October 1st. At 8:08 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Now, the goal is $4,500, and you're well on the way there, but we could stand some more help making sure that happens. So be sure to go to Manchild number 1-2, The Silver Age Meets the Modern Day, and be sure to back it so that Nandor can keep doing all these wonderful things. So keep up the wonderful stuff, Nandor, and look forward. Hopefully we get to talk with you again in the future sometime.
Yeah, Wayne, thank you so much. It was a pleasure. And I love talking about Manchild and Seasons. And I do want to let people know, too, that they can get all of my previous books on this Kickstarter. So if you're interested in Seasons or my other book, Lifeline or Manchild, you can get all of those in the Kickstarter. But it was great to be here. Thank you so much.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.
What's that?
Oh, the tumbler? Oh, you wouldn't be interested in that.
This baby works just fine.
So what do you think?
Does it come in black?